From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Barack Obama is not a he's not a monkey, he's not a chimpanzee. He is our president. And it's gonna take some people to get their jungle minds out of the gutter and realize they gotta get over it.
Protests are scheduled outside the New York Post today to condemn the publication of a cartoon that critics say depicts President Obama as a chimpanzee. We'll speak with New York State Senator Eric Adams. Then President Obama unveils his $275 billion plan to address the country's housing crisis.
The plan I'm announcing focuses on rescuing families who played by the rules and acted responsibly.
Then the Silent Depression, a new report on the racial wealth divide, and Obama makes his first foreign trip as president to Canada. Canada's the largest exporter of oil to the United States. Where does it come from? The Alberta tar sands. Greenpeace says it generates 3 to 5 times as much greenhouse gas pollution as the production of conventional oil. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Obama's unveiled a $275 billion program to address the national housing crisis. Speaking in Arizona, Obama said the Homeowner Affordability and Stability Plan could help as many as 9 million homeowners avoid foreclosure and reduce mortgage payments.
This plan will not save every home, but it will give millions of families resigned to financial ruin a chance to rebuild. It will prevent the worst consequences of this crisis from wreaking even greater havoc on the economy.
$75 billion would be allotted to help up to 4 million struggling homeowners by creating incentives for lenders to renegotiate the terms of subprime loans. The plan also promises to help an additional 5 million households struggling to pay off their mortgages by lifting restrictions on refinancing and by pledging an additional $200 billion for the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. A federal appeals court has blocked the release of 17 Muslim prisoners, Uyghurs, at Guantanamo Bay. The group was previously ordered to be resettled with other Uyghur families in the United States. But a 3-judge panel ruled District Judge Ricardo Urbina had erred on ordering their release into the United States. The U.S. government's admitted the men have been unlawfully detained, but won't send them back to China, where they face persecution. Emmy McLean of the Center for Constitutional Rights said, quote, the new administration must act quickly to remedy the failings of the old. If President Obama is committed to closing Guantanamo, he must allow these stranded Uyghurs into the United States. In Kyrgyzstan, lawmakers have voted to close a key U.S. airbase used for the occupation of Afghanistan. Earlier today, the Kyrgyz parliament voted 78-1 in favor of the shuttering of the Manas airbase. The base is a transit point for 15,000 troops and 500 tons of cargo each month. But it's become widely unpopular amidst opposition to U.S. foreign policy and controversy over U.S. refusal to pay a higher fee. The U.S. has also refused to revoke the immunity of a U.S. soldier who fatally shot a Kyrgyz truck driver in late 2006. The move comes one day after President Obama ordered an additional 17,000 troops to Afghanistan. The head of NATO forces in Afghanistan, General David McKiernan, praised the decision.
I am very delighted with the president's decision yesterday to send additional U.S. forces to reinforce our efforts in Afghanistan. I will use most of those forces in the southern part of Afghanistan, an area where we do not have sufficient security presence.
In Iraq, the trial of the Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at former President George W. Bush has been delayed until next month. Muntada al-Zaidi will stand trial in March on charges of assaulting a foreign leader. He faces 15 years in prison. Zaidi's attorney and family have alleged abusive treatment since his imprisonment. On Wednesday, Zaidi was applauded as he entered the courtroom. The Israeli government's formalized its stance to condition any easing of the blockade of the entire Gaza Strip on the release of a single captured Israeli soldier. On Wednesday, Interior Minister Meir Shatrit said Israel would only consider lifting the humanitarian siege of Gaza if Hamas secures Corporal Gilad Shalit's release.
The cabinet decided unanimously that Gilad Shalit will be the first demand of Israel before any arrangement with Egyptian or with Hamas. We'd like to see Gilad back home. 3 years have been passed, and we think that we cannot come to any arrangement with the Hamas or with the Egyptian without solving the problem of Gilad Shalit. We want him back home.
Gilad Shalit was seized in June 2006 from an Israeli military post used to stage attacks on Gaza. Israel's previously negotiated several prisoner exchanges. Some 10,000 Palestinians are currently jailed in Israeli prisons. Hamas spokesperson Fazi Bahoum called the Israeli position a non-starter and said Hamas remains open to a prisoner swap.
We will not accept linking the file of Shalit with the file of the ceasefire. If the Zionist occupier wanted a ceasefire with the breaking of the siege, the opening of the crossings, and a stopping of the aggression, then we are ready for that. If they wanted something other than that, then we are open to all possibilities.
In Egypt, the leading opposition politician, Ayman Nour, has been freed after more than 3 years in jail. Nour was jailed shortly after he challenged President Hosni Mubarak in national elections. The release was unexpected, as he still had nearly 2 years left in his sentence.
I say now that I've been released without any agreement, without any bargaining, without any deal. This was not offered, and if it had been, we wouldn't have accepted it. I'm out of prison to practice my rights as an Egyptian citizen.
Here in this country, former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan endorsed the nationalization of struggling U.S. banks. In an interview with the Financial Times, Greenspan said, quote, "It may be necessary to temporarily nationalize some banks in order to facilitate a swift and orderly restructuring. I understand that once in 100 years, this is what you do." Greenspan's embrace of neoliberal policies during his Fed tenure has been criticized for helping to cause today's financial crisis. Attorney General Eric Holder's calling for national dialogue on race. In a speech marking Black History Month, Holder called the U.S., quote, "a nation of cowards for not discussing the history of U.S. racism more openly." Holder's the nation's first African-American attorney general. In Florida, the tobacco giant Philip Morris has been ordered to pay $8 million in damages to the widow of a smoker who died of lung cancer. Elaine Hess's husband, Stuart Hess, died in 1997 at the age of 55. Philip Morris faces some 8,000 similar lawsuits in Florida alone. The company says it plans to appeal. In Miami, federal prosecutors have launched their third attempt to convict six men accused of plotting to destroy FBI buildings in Chicago's Sears Tower. The two previous trials ended in a deadlocked jury. In other news from Miami, activists have called a protest for Saturday over U.S. government plans to deport some 30,000 Haitians. Earlier this year, the Bush administration rejected a Haitian request to delay the deportations until Haiti recovers from a string of deadly summer storms. Here in New York, several dozen student activists have barricaded themselves inside a cafeteria at New York University. The group, Take Back NYU, has submitted several demands, including the establishment of a socially responsible committee, a full disclosure of the school's annual budget, and support for Palestinian students in the Gaza Strip.
The first two orders of the Socially Responsible Finance Committee will be an in-depth investigation of all investments in war and genocide profiteers. As well as companies profiting from the occupation of Palestine.
The family of the 19th century Apache Indian warrior Geronimo has filed a lawsuit seeking to recover his remains. The suit names the U.S. government, Yale University, and the Yale Student Society Skull and Bones. According to legends, Skull and Bones members, including former President George Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, dug up Geronimo's remains from his burial plot in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. The Swiss banking giant UBS has agreed to release the names of wealthy American account holders believed to be using offshore accounts to avoid paying taxes. The agreement came as part of a $780 million fraud settlement with the IRS. Prosecutors say UBS helped wealthy American clients hide at least $1.5 billion in taxes from 2002 to 2007. And finally, the Sudanese novelist Al-Tayyib Saleh has died at the age of 80. He was considered one of the Arab world's top novelists, with books including the 1966 classic The Season of Migration to the North. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. A series of protests are scheduled outside the New York Post today to condemn the publication of a cartoon that critics say depicts President Obama as a chimpanzee. The cartoon, drawn by Sean Delonis, shows a white police officer shooting dead a chimpanzee in the street. His partner, another white officer, says, quote, they'll have to find someone else to write the next stimulus bill. The cartoon appeared in the paper 2 days after police in Connecticut shot dead a chimp in the streets of Stamford and 1 day after President Obama signed the economic stimulus bill. The Reverend Al Sharpton said, quote, the cartoon in today's New York Post is troubling at best, given the historic racist attacks of African Americans as being synonymous with monkeys. The National Association of Black Journalists called the cartoon the lowest common denominator of taste and class.
New York Post editor-in-chief Carl Allen denied the cartoon was racially charged. In a statement, Allen said, quote, the cartoon is a clear parody of a current news event, to wit, the shooting of a violent chimpanzee in Connecticut. It broadly mocks Washington's efforts to revive the economy. Again, Al Sharpton reveals himself as nothing more than a publicity opportunist, he said. We're joined now by two guests. Eric Adams is a state senator here in New York. He protested outside the New York Post on Wednesday. He's planning to be there again today for a major protest at noon. He's the former head of the organization 100 Blacks and Law Enforcement Who Care. We're joined in Baltimore by Diedrich Muhammad. He's a senior organizer and research associate at the Institute for Policy Studies, former national field director for Reverend Al Sharpton's National Action Network. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! State Senator Eric Adams, your response.
Well, I believe that when you look at the drawing, the caricature, and on the next page, you saw that you had Obama actually signing a bill to state that it was a broad description of what took place in D.C. I think that's ridiculous. That in itself is a joke. The fact is, there weren't several chimpanzees being shot. There weren't hundreds of legislators being shot. There was one. There's one author of the stimulus package. That's Barack Obama. That correlation, I believe, clearly showed that this was a way of just continuing the method of just degrading not only Barack Obama, but African Americans in power. There are those who are troubled by the fact that we have an African American president. We have an African-American governor, an African-American leader of the Senate for the first time in almost 60-somewhat years. So there's a pattern that's developing, and we
here
need to bring
New
it
York.
To the forefront. Yes, we need to bring it to the forefront.
Eric Adams, the New York Post has had a checkered relationship, obviously, with the black community for many years. Now I heard that City Councilman Charles Barron is calling for an all-out boycott now and an extended boycott of the paper. You get a sense that this is going to have much resonance or support within the black community?
Yeah, what's interesting here, what I was surprised of, is that historically, I think that what is often hidden is that even the communities of color is broken to sections. You have those who are affluent New Yorkers, those who are what one would consider everyday middle class New Yorkers, and those who are just basically making it every day. Obama had the ability, his campaign had the ability to bring a common denominator for all those groups. And when I started receiving calls from individuals who I know who are developers and doing very well, individuals who are accountants or engineers, as well as those who are just basically trying to hold on to their home, everyone was motivated by the campaign, and that same level of motivation is wanting to see the Post close down. So I think the Post hit a nerve that went throughout the entire anatomy of the communities of color and also outside the community of color. When you look at my district, it's a district that is one of the most diverse districts in the country, and all of the groups in that district were concerned about the Post article.
This isn't the first controversial cartoon of Delanis. 2001 cartoon depicted Fernando Ferrer, the Bronx Borough president, seeking the Democratic nomination for mayor, kissing the buttocks of Mr. Sharpton. Depiction that was widely criticized as demeaning and racist. I'm looking at the web piece in the New York Times last night. And it goes on to talk about how the cartoonist has drawn ire from a number of groups for past cartoons. In 2006, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation denounced a cartoon of his that showed a man carrying a sheep wearing a bridal veil to a New Jersey marriage licenses window, a reference to the state Supreme Court's ruling that year requiring the state to grant same-sex couples the same legal advice. Rights and benefits as heterosexual couples through civil unions. Diedrich Mohammed, you're in Baltimore. These protests are taking place, a big one today at noon in front of the New York Post. Your response to this ad and to the New York Post simply denouncing the man you used to work for, Al Sharpton, saying he was simply a publicity seeker, and saying that this just referred to those in Washington.
Well, I mean, it's, again, as Eric had pointed out, I mean, the New York Post has a history of being quite reactionary and of being generally offensive to African-American leaders, whether it's Reverend Al Sharpton in 2001 or whether now it's Barack Obama, President Barack Obama in 2009. And, you know, outside of just this being a New York issue, clearly, I know African-Americans and supporters of Barack across the country are outraged by this. And I think the New York Post is going to find itself that it can't just blame this incident on Reverend Sharpton, who simply put forth a comment that I think many Americans agree with, but going to have to take responsibility for their own actions. And it's one thing for a cartoonist to draw this. It's another thing for the editorial board or the editors at the New York Post to decide that this is something appropriate and that they're going to defend it.
This controversy is flaring as Attorney General Eric Holder gave an historic speech yesterday marking Black History Month. Holder told employees at the Justice Department that the United States is a, quote, nation of cowards when it comes to discussing race. Eric Holder is the nation's first African-American attorney general. This is an excerpt of what he had to say.
One cannot truly understand America without understanding the historical experience of Black people in this nation. Simply put, to get to the heart of this country, one must examine its racial soul. Though this nation has proudly thought of itself as a ethnic melting pot, in things racial, we have always been, and we, I believe, continue to be, in too many ways, essentially a nation of cowards. Though race-related issues continue to occupy a significant portion of our political discussion, and though there remain many unresolved racial issues in this nation, we, average Americans, simply do not talk enough with each other about things racial. It is an issue that we have never been at ease with, and given our nation's history, this is in some ways understandable. And yet, if we are to make progress in this area, we must feel comfortable enough with one another and tolerant enough of each other to have frank conversations about the racial matters that continue to divide us. But we must do more. And we in this room bear a special responsibility. Through its work and through its example, the Department of Justice, this Department of Justice, as long as I'm here, must and will lead the nation to the new birth of freedom so long ago promised by our greatest president. This is our duty. This is our solemn responsibility. We commemorated 5 years ago the 50th anniversary of the landmark Brown versus the Board of Education decision. And though the world that we now live in is fundamentally different than that which existed then, this nation has still not come to grips with its racial past, nor has it been willing to contemplate in a truly meaningful way the diverse future it is fated to have. To our detriment, this is typical of the way in which this nation deals with issues of race. And so I would suggest that we use February of every year to not only commemorate Black history, but also to foster a period of dialogue between the races. Our history has demonstrated that the vast majority of Americans are uncomfortable with and would like to not have to deal with racial matters, and that is why those of us, black or white, elected or self-appointed, who promise relief and easy, quick solutions, no matter how divisive, people like that are too often embraced. We are then free to retreat to our race-protected cocoons, where much is comfortable and where progress is not really made. If we allow this attitude to persist in the face of the most significant demographic changes that this nation has ever faced, and remember, there will be no majority race in the United States in about 50 years, the coming diversity that could be such a powerful, positive force will instead become a reason for stagnation and polarization.
Attorney General Eric Holder giving a major address yesterday. He is the first African-American attorney general. Juan?
Eric Adams, I'd like to ask you, obviously, after the election of President Obama, many people were saying that the country had made major strides now in terms of dealing with the racism in the country. And then you get something like this at the New York Post, and you say, wait a second, what kind of strides are being made by some sectors of the population? Your sense in terms of, especially in terms of what Eric Holder said and in terms of what's happened in the last few days with the New York Post?
Well, I think we're at a crossroad, and I think one of the dangers, believe it or not, of Barack's President Obama's election is the fact that many people are going to say everything is fine now, when in reality it is not. And I'm hoping that what we saw with Eric Holder and others, now that the door is cracked, we need to kick it open. We need to look and see diversity on the editorial boards, look at diversity in the newsrooms across the country. Where are we as anchor persons, and where we in the news industry? When something like this can slip through the cracks, when there's a vetting process to decide what stories and what photos are going to go in the paper, it shows you that down the line, the entire system, there's a problem. And without the proper diversity to say something is wrong with this photo, you can't have a group of people who all think alike and act alike. Now we got to put this discussion to the front page.
Very quickly, State Senator Eric Holder, you're formerly head of 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care. Eric Adams.
I wish I was older.
So you're a former cop.
Yes.
We just passed the 10th anniversary of the killing of Amadou Diallo by four police officers in this city, died in a hail of 41 police bullets. And beyond that, right now, a report that just came out from the Center for Constitutional Rights, newly released data from, shows city police officers made a record 530,000 stop and frisks. 80% of the people stopped or frisked were Latino or Black. Only 10% were white, who comprised 44% of the city. Last year, CCR, the Center for Constitutional Rights, sued the city, charging its policy of conducting unconstitutional stop and frisks singles out ethnic minorities. Your response to the state of affairs?
I think when we view back this generation, we often look at Giuliani as one of the harshest mayor in our times. I believe history is going to show that Bloomberg was far worse than Giuliani, and Commissioner Kelly was far worse than Howard Safer. When you look at the numbers, the former Attorney General Elliot Spitzer stated for every stop that's recorded, four goes unrecorded. So when you do the math, we're talking about the possibility of 2 million young people being stopped, questioned, and frisked because the ages fall in that group. These young people have been criminalized, and many of them did no crime at all but had the wrong skin pigmentation. So it's imperative that we look at this and make sure we use government to do the right things.
Well, we'll be covering you today at the protest outside the New York Post at noon, New York State Senator Eric Holder. When we come back, we'll go. I can't let it go. Eric Adams. When we come back, we'll stay with Dietrich Muhammad. Institute for Policy Studies has just come out with a report, The Silent Depression, about the racial wealth divide. And then we'll look at the foreclosure speech of President Obama yesterday and what it means. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting over 750 stations on Pacific and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV 940, Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. More video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take or for you to read in transcript form. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan.
Well, the Federal Reserve predicted on Wednesday the nation's unemployment rate could rise to nearly 9% this year, far higher than previously expected. In November, the Fed predicted the unemployment rate would not exceed 7.6% in 2009, but it has already hit that mark. The unemployment rate remains highest among people of color. Black unemployment is now at over 12.6%, and the jobless rate for young men, black men, is considerably higher. Tijik Mohammed, who is still with us in Baltimore, is co-author of a new report titled State of the Dream 2009, The Silent Depression, published by United for a Fair Economy. The report found people of color in the United States are already experiencing a silent economic depression. Jidrick Mohammed, lay out some of the findings in your report.
Well, I think one of the most important findings is that the idea that the African-American community never emerged out of the 2001 recession. As the country was talking about things that were going well in 2005, 2006, we saw that African-Americans were actually having a decline in the employment rate, a decline in a per capita income. So African-Americans, and actually you're going to see more and more working-class Americans, were going through actually a recession for years. And now we're really at a state where things are getting so bad that I would call it a depression. I mean, we're looking at African-American, as you said, unemployment rate about 13%. This foreclosure crisis is disproportionately going to affect African-American and Latino community who are specifically targeted with predatory lending. So we're really dealing with a national crisis, but a crisis that's going to hurt working class communities, which are disproportionately people of color. And as you mentioned, Eric Holder's statement, there hasn't been enough courage by political officials to adequately deal with this, with some of these unique situations that's really going to require the nation's resources.
And this high unemployment rate comes on top of an existing wealth gap that is rarely talked about, too, so that in the African American and Latino communities, families don't have much in terms of assets to fall back on in hard times. Isn't that true?
Oh, that's absolutely right. The overwhelming majority of African Americans and Latinos do not even have a savings enough that would keep them going for 3 months. And as you see, growing unemployment and what's not talked enough about, underemployment, there is not that safety cushion to help you get through a hard times. African Americans only have about 15% of the wealth of white Americans. And so, again, African American community, Latinos communities, and also just working class communities as a whole are in a much more dire situation than I think is truly recognized. And we need some political courage to deal with these issues adequately.
The unemployment rate overall, they're talking 7, 8, 9, 10%. People gasp. But you say that unemployment for African Americans is in the double digits. Talk about where they are now and where you see it going.
Well, the most recent data I've seen is that African American unemployment rate is around 13%. And there are estimates now, which I think are correct, that African American unemployment can reach up to 20% and higher. When you look back a year ago, every estimate of how bad things are going to be underestimated how bad things currently are. And I think that's still going to be true. So, and if you look, I mean, the current unemployment rate of about 13% is a higher unemployment rate that white Americans haven't had such a high unemployment rate since about the time of the Depression. So we're truly in a crisis, and I'm hoping that there'll be more bold statements by people like Eric Holder, by political officials, about how are we going to address this racial wealth divide. Because I think the fact that America has been a nation of cowards in dealing with this issue, people are scared to deal with the issue which they consider divisive. But what's truly divisive is the fact that a third of black children are living in poverty, that indigenous people are living in a state that most Americans don't realize, and that we haven't gotten past the long legacy of disenfranchisement of people of color in this country.
Well, in the past week, we've seen the announcements, well, the signing of the stimulus package and also the announcement of President Obama's mortgage foreclosure plan to deal with the mortgage crisis. How do you see these two initiatives affecting the situation in the black community?
What I see is that the economic stimulus package, I see as much more as the economic survival package. I mean, important things are in it, like extending unemployment benefits, trying to help people with health insurance. But these are more so going to help people get through this rough economic time. It's not going to get them out of this rough economic time. And again, if the idea is just to stimulate the economy, just get the economy going again like it was in the 90s, African Americans were still had a third of black children living in poverty that time period. It's not good enough for me to go back to the 90s where we have a growing economy but maintaining great racial inequality. We have to do something much different and have to have much more bolder proposals. I'm glad to see that the government realizes that they have to play a role in stimulating the economy. I hope they see that their role is also to stimulate greater racial equality in this country.
What do you mean when you write, to a large extent, African Americans never emerged from the 2001 recession?
What I mean is through 2001 through about 2007, African American employment rate was actually declining. The per capita income was also declining. And you can even go back a little further than that and look at, I mean, even for white working men, they for the last 20 years have been had their income declining. The middle class, the working class in this country have been suffering economically and have been using debt to maintain a middle class lifestyle. These chickens have come home to roost. We can no longer use this debt. And now I think we're realizing that for many Americans, the middle class lifestyle is unsustainable. And the large question has to be, what are we going to do about this?
Diedrich Muhammad, thanks for joining us. Senior organizer and research associate at the Institute for Policy Studies. The report, State of the Dream 2009 with United for a Fair Economy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Juan?
Well, President Obama unveiled his first concrete plan to address the country's dire housing crisis at his speech in Phoenix, Arizona, Wednesday. His $275 billion homeowner affordability and stability plan could help as many as 9 million homeowners avoid foreclosure and reduce mortgage payments. Obama announced the details of the plan after warning that not acting would aggravate the crisis that is, quote, unraveling home ownership, the middle class, and the American dream itself.
The plan I'm announcing focuses on rescuing families who played by the rules and acted responsibly. By refinancing loans for millions of families in traditional mortgages who are underwater or close to it, by modifying loans for families stuck in subprime mortgages they can't afford as a result of skyrocketing interest rates or personal misfortune, and by taking broader steps to keep mortgage rates low so that families can secure loans with affordable monthly payments. And through this plan, we will help between 7 and 9 million families restructure or refinance their mortgages so they can avoid foreclosure. And we're not just helping homeowners at risk of falling over the edge, we're preventing their neighbors from being pulled over that edge too, as defaults and foreclosures contribute to sinking home values and failing local businesses and lost jobs. But I want to be very clear about what this plan will not do. It will not rescue the unscrupulous or irresponsible by throwing good taxpayer money after bad loans. It will not help speculators. It will not help speculators who took risky bets on a rising market and bought homes not to live in but to sell. It will not help dishonest lenders who acted irresponsibly, distorting the facts. Distorting the facts and dismissing the fine print at the expense of buyers who didn't know better. And it will not reward folks who bought homes they knew from the beginning they would never be able to afford. So I just want to make this clear. This plan will not save every home.
That's President Obama in Arizona yesterday. The bill would put in $75 billion to help up to 4 million homeowners at risk of losing their homes by creating incentives for lenders to renegotiate the terms of subprime loans. It also promises to help an additional 5 million households struggling to pay off their mortgages by lifting restrictions on refinancing and by pledging $200 billion to strengthen mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were bailed out by the government last year. We're joined now by Josh Zinner here in the Firehouse studio. He's the co-director of Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project, or NEDAP. He previously served as director of the Foreclosure Prevention Project at South Brooklyn Legal Services. Welcome to Democracy Now! Do you think this is going to do it?
Well, let me say it's a good start. You know, we're heartened. You know, the positive here is that finally something is being done by government. This crisis has been festering for such a long time. And we sat through years of the Bush administration doing nothing. And then when it became apparent that something desperately needed to be done, what happened was a voluntary agreement with mortgage servicers where somehow the industry was going to police itself. And that fell completely flat and has worsened the crisis substantially. So we're very heartened that there is at least a plan on the table for the government to intervene, and it's a great start. And it's definitely going to help a great number of people, but it falls short in a number of critical areas.
Well, you know, I tried this morning and yesterday to delve into the summaries of how the plan would work. And I confess I had a lot of difficulty understanding, especially the portion where the president is talking about getting banks to agree to renegotiate deals to a certain income level. I think something about the 38, if the banks could get it down, the renegotiated loan to 38% of a family's income, the government would then get it down to 31%. Could you explain how that would work?
Yeah, the mechanism, the reason you were confused is because a lot of the details are not laid out, and I think all of us are waiting to see how it plays out. But the way it's been explained so far is that if lenders agree to get the debt to income, and this means the borrower's gross income, the ratio of the monthly mortgage payment plus taxes and insurance to the borrower's gross monthly income, if the lender agrees to bring down the payments to 38% of debt to income, then the government will help subsidize dollar for dollar a reduction of that debt to income down to 31%. And that 31% is widely viewed and is an affordable mortgage amount. So if this works in getting the mortgage payments down to 31% for a substantial number of borrowers, it will be a significant help.
But how would the banks do that? Would they accept a loss on the actual value of the property, or would they extend the length of the loan? How would they actually get that those payments down to 38% of a family's income?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've gotten to one of sort of the crux of the issue here. And I can talk in a minute about sort of what's lacking here is enough of a stick to push mortgage servicers to actually significantly move from where they are now. But
because this would all be voluntary, right?
It would be voluntary primarily. The idea in the plan right now is to have mortgage servicers, the entities that actually are servicing these loans that are collecting from the borrowers, that are contracted out to do that, to reduce interest rates to get the loan down to 38%. There's a mention that they can reduce the principal of the loan, cut actually the amount that is owed, but there's really very little incentive, it appears, to get them to do this, and this is really what's needed. The only stick so far in the plan is that institutions that get money from the TARP, from the financial bailout, are compelled to at least try to work within this program. They're not compelled to do loan modifications, but they're compelled to follow the criteria in the program, which as of yet has not been specifically laid out. But there is a stick there. There's some confusion, though, because these subprime mortgages, the ones that are causing such high rates of default, are bundled up in these complex securitizations where they're bundled to Wall Street and sold off to investors. So it's not clear Is it the mortgage servicer that needs to, that is the one that gets TARP money? Is it the entity that is the trustee on the securitization plan? So there, it is somewhat vague there, and so that.
What are the sticks that are needed?
The stick that the biggest stick that's needed, it was mentioned in the plan. It's reform to the bankruptcy laws. It's a reform specifically.
The bankruptcy laws that Vice President Joe Biden, a senator, was fierce in pushing through.
That's absolutely true, and we hope that his position has changed. You know, certainly his position on the 2005 bankruptcy bill was problematic to those of us who are representing low-income people. The change that's needed at this time is a change that would allow bankruptcy judges in Chapter 13 proceedings to modify the terms of mortgages, that would allow judges to force servicers to change the terms of mortgages. Right now, interestingly enough, if there's a bankruptcy filing, a judge can change the terms of a mortgage on a second home, on a vacation home. A judge can change the terms of the mortgage unilaterally on a yacht. But on somebody's primary residence that they're living in, that their family's living in, under bankruptcy laws right now, they cannot do that. This is the absolute crux, that is the absolute critical thing that's needed for this plan to work. Congress needs to pass a bankruptcy reform bill that would allow judges to do a couple of things. First of all, to cram down the amount of the mortgage owed. So many people are underwater. They owe more on their mortgage than their house is actually worth. And this plan right now would do little for them. In bankruptcy, what a judge could do is cram down the amount owed down to the value of the property. And then a judge would be able to modify the terms of the mortgage, reduce interest rates, freeze interest rates on adjustable mortgages, adjustable rate mortgages, extend the terms of loans. The reason this is so critical is not just because borrowers could then go into bankruptcy court and get the modifications needed to make their loans affordable. The reason it's critical is that right now there's really no stick to mortgage servicers. There's nothing to force them to do these modifications that are in everybody's best interest, and they're not doing them. If they're facing an impending bankruptcy filing, that's going to change dramatically, and it will cause them to do a lot more modifications within the parameters of the plan. So these changes are really critical for this plan to work.
And the other question is, how rapidly would this begin start to be implemented?
Well, they say that the implementation will begin on March 4th. But again, there's a couple of problems. First of all, you know, we think that for it to become truly effective, these bankruptcy changes need to go through, and that's not going to happen by March 4th. And second, we think that there needs to be, at the very least, a voluntary foreclosure freeze by the industry to hold off on filing foreclosures and on moving forward on foreclosures for a significant period of time until this plan can be allowed to work. So, although implementation starts March 4th, it's not going to work unless there are these other moving parts.
One of the other questions I have is, given the fact that the lack of regulation was a major reason why we got into this problem in the first place, government oversight of the lending practices, what's to prevent this new plan from becoming prey also to financial scam artists who will now suddenly deluge homeowners who are in problems with ways to get them to refinance or to fix their mortgage problems?
That's a very good point. I mean, I think in general, there's a big problem out there in the market, whether it's through this plan or in general in the mortgage markets going forward, that, you know, what mechanisms are in place to prevent these problems from occurring again? I mean, what's needed on a very is very broad and significant regulation of the entire financial services industry, not just of mortgage lending, but also of Wall Street. Credit rating agencies need to be very strictly regulated, and mortgage servicers and the investment banks that pool these mortgages together. There needs to be very broad regulation of the industry. One thing that is somewhat outrageous, or very outrageous, I think, to many of us, is that The same financial institutions that have taken billions and billions in bailout money from taxpayers are now using that bailout money, or indirectly using the bailout money, to continue lobbying in Washington to water down any potential regulations that come up. And this is a big problem. Our view is, look, you had your chance. You lobbied for years to weaken regulation, and look what happens. You've effectively destroyed the economy of the world, and now you have to back off. You're taking taxpayer money. You have to let the public institute policies that are going to be beneficial to the public. You can't continue to use your lobbying clout to, for example, lobby against the bankruptcy reform that I'm talking about, as you've done for many years. It's a new ball game, and the financial institutions really, there's a serious problem with them using money to lobby.
We just have 10 seconds, but any comment on the new director of the White House Office on Urban Policy, Bronx Borough President from right here in New York, Adolfo Carrion? Have you worked with him?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, we're encouraged here in New York City. We hope that it will give New York City advocates certainly a say and a place at the table. And certainly he's somebody that understands urban issues and issues that affect people of color and communities of color. So it is encouraging.
We'll leave it there. Josh Zinner, thanks for joining us, co-director of the Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project, known as NEDAP, here in New York. This is Democracy Now! We go from TARP to tar sands. We're going up to Canada, where President Barack Obama is making his first foreign trip as president. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. And Juan, is it Yes Week Canada?
Well, President Barack Obama is heading to Canada today for his first foreign trip as president. Obama and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper are expected to discuss trade issues, energy and the environment. A coalition of environmental groups is urging President Obama to cut back on America's dependence on oil from the tar sands in Alberta, Canada. Canada now exports more oil to the United States than any other country. About 75% of Canadian oil comes from the Alberta tar sands.
Extracting and upgrading synthetic crude oil from tar sands is incredibly energy intensive. According to Greenpeace, it generates 3 to 5 times as much greenhouse gas pollution as the production of conventional oil. On Wednesday, a group of Greenpeace activists hung a pair of banners over a bridge in Ottawa that read, "Welcome President Obama and climate leaders don't buy tar sands." Mike Hoodma is with us from Ottawa. He's a climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace Canada, longtime activist from Alberta, Canada. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mike. Explain what the tar sands are. I think people will be shocked to hear how much oil the U.S. gets from Canada.
Well, definitely. The tar sands are the largest energy and industrial project right now on the face of the planet. And they're much unlike conventional oil operations. To get a single barrel of oil from the tar sands, it does require 3 to 5 times as much energy as a conventional barrel of oil. In addition to that, it requires about 3 to 5 barrels of fresh water to get a single barrel of oil out of the tar sands. And when you consider that over 1.3 million barrels of oil are produced every single day, it's quite a dramatic impact. In addition, you know, tar sands are very unlike conventional oil operations. What you're getting out of the ground is not a liquid substance, but a very viscous, heavy substance, much like tar, called bitumen. To get that out of the ground, of course, you know, requires vast amounts of energy, but the extraction process is fundamentally different as well. So you're not looking at traditional pump and jack wells like conventional oil operations, but you're looking at either a process of creating vast strip mines, much like coal strip mining, where you basically scrape away the boreal forest, everything above the Earth's surface, and then you're slowly carving out these mines that are, in some cases, over 100 meters deep. In other cases, you're building deep in situ technology, where you're creating these vast well pads using natural gas or coal to superheat steam, which is then pumped underneath the ground to superheat the earth to basically melt the substance so that you can take it out. So, as you can imagine, that process is very destructive. The area available for tar sands leasing is about 149,000 square kilometers, which in American terms is about the size of the state of Florida. So you're looking at vast impacts on fish, on animal species, and of course First Nations in the area, and then all of us when you look at some of the climate and water impacts of the tar sands development.
Well, President Obama discussed the Alberta tar sands during an interview on CBC this week. He was asked about the issue by CBC host Peter Mansbridge.
A lot of oil and gas comes to the United States from Canada, and even more in the future with oil sands development. Now, there are some in your country and Canada as well who feel the oil sands is dirty oil because of the extraction process. What do you think? Is it dirty oil?
Well, what we know is that oil sands creates a big carbon footprint. And so the dilemma that Canada faces, the United States faces, and China and the entire world faces is how do we obtain the energy that we need to grow our economies in a way that is not rapidly accelerating climate change? That's one of the reasons why the stimulus bill that I'll be signing today contains billions of dollars towards clean energy development. I think to the extent that Canada and the United States can collaborate on ways that we can sequester carbon, capture greenhouse gases before they're emitted into the atmosphere. And ultimately, I think this can be solved by technology. I think that it is possible for us to create a set of clean energy mechanisms that allow us to use things not just like oil sands, but also coal. The United States is the Saudi Arabia of coal, but we have our own homegrown problems in terms of dealing with a cheap energy source that creates a big carbon footprint. And so we're not going to be able to deal with any of these issues in isolation. The more that we can develop technologies that tap alternative sources of energy, but also contain the environmental damage of fossil fuels, the better off we're going to be.
That was President Obama discussing with CBC his view on the tar sands issue. Mike Hudima, the actual process by which those tar sands are turned into oil, how does that occur?
Well, there's two methods that I talked about briefly. One is by creating these vast open pit strip mines, which are really very much like coal strip mines. And so you're looking at scraping away everything above the topsoil. Industry likes to refer to it as overburden. We like to call it boreal forest or ecosystems. All of that is scraped away. There's also a vast amount of wetlands in the area, so all of those are drained, and then you start carving into the earth. And so you're building these mines that in some cases are over 100 meters deep, kilometers and kilometers or miles and miles wide, and they're very vast. They use the largest steam shovels in the world, the largest dump trucks in the world to excavate the dirt as fast as possible so that they can get to the bitumen deposits. So that's one type of extraction method. The other type that is, looks, and the industry refers to it as more environmentally sensitive, but the impacts are actually more severe than the mining operations, are what is called deep in situ or SAGD operations, steam-assisted gravity drilling. And basically what happens in these operations is you build a network of gigantic well pads. And so in order to get to the well pads, of course, you need roads and infrastructure. And so the impact on the surrounding area is just as vast as the mining operations. Once you build these well pads, what you're using is natural gas or coal to superheat steam. You'll pump that underneath the ground, which of course, will superheat the earth to try and melt this very viscous substance so that they can actually suck it out. Of course, the deep in situ actually uses more energy and uses more water than the mining operations, and so is very impactful from a water perspective, from a human rights perspective, and then definitely from a climate perspective. It definitely pushes us in the wrong direction at a time where we need to be reducing our emissions, not increasing. increasing them. And with the tar sands, they're the largest cause of greenhouse gas emission growth in Canada. By 2020, they'll potentially emit over 141 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions into the air every single year. To put that in perspective, that's almost double what all the cars and light trucks in all of Canada produce. So it's more than entire countries is what's coming out of the tar sands in Alberta.
So, Mike Udima, the president says that U.S. and Canada should collaborate on ways to capture carbon and then store it to prevent greenhouse gases from being emitted into the atmosphere. But a group of 50 prominent Canadians sent Obama a letter yesterday saying it would be wrong to have faith in untried methods. They said, quote, costly and unproven technological fixes such as carbon capture and storage do not provide silver bullet solutions to addressing emissions from tar sands. Mike Udima, who is pushing this?
Well, definitely the people that are pushing it are the Alberta government, the federal government, and Prime Minister Harper is definitely at the lead of that. And then, of course, in the tar sands, you have every major international oil company being involved in the extraction. And so you have oil companies from around the world, from Exxon, Imperial, Shell, Total, Statoil, Hydro, British Petroleum. Everybody is wanting to get a piece of the tar sands because it is a money-making opportunity for them. But, of course, it comes with an ever-growing environmental and human rights price tag. And when you talk about carbon capture and sequestration, definitely we don't see it as we see it more as a smokescreen than a silver bullet. What you have is the federal government and the provincial government here in Canada convened a task force to look into the possibilities of carbon capture when it comes to the tar sands. And what the task force's own findings were was that it had very little implications when it comes to tar sands because of how many different point sources of emissions that you have within the tar sands and because of the variability within that. So when you have the government's own advisor saying that there's a very limited role, it's hard to put any faith in carbon capture at all.
And what percentage of Canada's own supply of oil and of the United States is dependent on the tar sands?
Well, definitely a huge percentage. Canada, of course, is the largest supplier of oil to the United States, and the majority of that is coming from the tar sands. So there definitely is a huge dependency issue. Where we are seeing very hopeful signs are on things like where President Obama finally allowed states to increase fuel economy standards for the first time in decades. And so seeing that is a real sign that we're starting to decrease our dependency on tar sands fuels. The other thing that provides a very hopeful sign coming from the U.S. Is states like California that have implemented a low carbon fuel standard, which is also going to be potentially adopted by 13 northeastern states. And then Obama has talked about making it a national low-carbon fuel standard as well. And what that would do is really look at, the greenhouse footprint of the type of sources that are coming into the U.S. fuel supply and would slowly start to eliminate those sources that have a higher greenhouse gas footprint.
Mike Udima, we're going to have to end it there. Speaking to us from Ottawa with Greenpeace, thanks so much for joining us. That does it for the show. Happy belated Valentine's birthday to Mike Kimber and best of health to WBI's Bernard White. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.